may recall that the first lecture in this series on the new frontiers of the Spirit, I spoke of the originality of Moses. Moses was the first among the titans of the human spirit to draw aside the dark curtains and to open up new vistas for the spiritual life of man. He taught man the unity of God and how to worship God, not through images or idols, but through the moral life. And it was Moses who set the moral life at the very core of religion. And by a covenant which he made between Israel and Yahweh, Adonai, having first made of Israel a people, he then made it an Am Kadosh, a holy people, designated for it the task of becoming a Mamlechet Kohanim, a kingdom of priests, to preserve for itself for all future times these great ethical and spiritual teachings which he gave them, which we find in the Devarim, the words which God spoke to Moses. Moses then was the pioneer, the pathfinder, a genius of extraordinary originality. This morning, I want to speak to you about the originality of the prophets who followed Moses much later, who were also men of great originality, but of a different kind. The originality of the prophets was that of what you might call dedicated discipleship. Their originality consisted not in discovering new truth, but in proclaiming to unwilling ears and to the ages which did backslide from the original Torah of Moses, the old truths, in summoning generations of men, sinful and corrupt, back to the ways of justice and righteousness which had been marked out for them. These prophets spoke with deep passion and with rare eloquence of the ancient code and of the holy covenant which had been made and which the people seemingly had forgotten. And there had never been men like unto them before or since for courage, for dedication, and for sacrifice. Now, there have been scholars who trace the beginning of spiritual Judaism to these great literary prophets, Amos, Hosea, Micah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and the others, who lived during the 8th through the 6th centuries before the Common Era. And prior to that time, these men maintain the religion of Israel was little different from the religions of all of its heathen neighbors. The Canaanites had their Baal, Moabites had their Chemosh, and the Israelites had their Yahweh, their Adonai. And it was a literary prophet who introduced the new concepts of religion and ethics to the world, who pointed out to radical new departures in ways of thinking about God and of worshiping Him. Now, nothing can be further from the truth. The prophets of Israel, from Amos down, including even the non-literary prophets, that are those who have not left their preachings in writing, prophets like Samuel and Nathan, Gad, Elijah, these prophets did not create the religion of Israel. They would have been the last to make such a claim. They never conceived of themselves as innovators or originators of the ideas which they proclaimed to the people. They regarded themselves as having been sent to remind the people of what they had forgotten, to recall them to a faith and a way of life which their ancestors had chosen to adopt, but which their descendants had chosen to ignore. These prophets came to alert the people to their corruptions, to their backslidings, and to warn them of the retribution which was sure to follow. The prophet in very truth was what he is called in the Bible, the Mochiach Bashar, he who reproved in the gates, he who summoned the people to repentance for sins committed against moral laws which were very well known to them. And Jeremiah clearly defined the mission of the prophet. Obey the voice, my voice, and I will be your God. When God brought the people of Israel out of Egypt, he gave them this command: obey my voice, and I will be your God. But they did not obey. Whereupon God sent them time and again his servants, the prophets. Yet they did not listen to them. And they did not obey the voice of God. They did not accept discipline. Lo lakhu musar. The people consistently refused to take correction. Me'anu lakachat musar. So that the function of the prophet was to bring musar, correction, discipline, to sound a call to repentance. Nevertheless, they were disobedient and rebelled against thee and cast thy law behind their back and killed thy prophets who had warned them in order to turn them back to thee. The prophet spoke with the authority of divine inspiration as the restorers of the true and ancient faith to a generation which had ignored or forgotten it. The prophet Micah defined his calling in this way: but as for me, I am filled with power, with the spirit of Yahweh, the spirit of Adonai, with justice and might, to declare to Jacob his transgression and to Israel his sin. And he reminds the people that God already told them what is good and what he requires of them. He already told them do justice, love kindness, and walk in probity, or as it is translated, walk humbly with him. Now, what were these sins and transgressions which the prophets condemned? Not one which is not already itemized in the great words in the Devarim of the original Torah of Moses. the prophets from Samuel down held up to condemnation the worship of other gods, the making of images, and the indecent practices which were connected with the various fertility cults, such as sacred prostitution, the burnt offering of children, and all forms of witchcraft and sorcery. The prophets denounced the perversion of justice, the taking of bribes, the shedding of innocent blood, the oppression of the poor, the orphan, and the widow, the overreaching and the covetousness of the rich, the resorting to the wicked scales and the bag of deceitful weights, and the swearing, lying, killing, stealing, and committing adultery. It is these practices, and these idolatries, which the prophets condemned by various forms of condemnation, by terms of utmost contempt, especially by the term to'evah, abominable, despicable. That was the utmost in condemnation. There were no new ethical demands which the prophets made upon the people, and none are to be found in their prophecies. They were pleading with their people to return, as Jeremiah put it, to return to the ancient paths where the good way is, and walk in it, and find rest for your souls. These prophets reminded the people that the Torah which their ancestors had received in the wilderness after they left Egypt at Sinai, that Torah, that original Torah of Moses, said nothing about sacrifices and nothing about sanctuaries. Neither Jerusalem, which was the capital later on of the kingdom of Judea, nor Bethel or Dan, which were sanctuaries in the northern kingdom of Israel, none of these places, they maintained, was at all important for the true worship of Yahweh, of Adonai. They're not in themselves the dwelling place of Adonai, nor are they the exclusive places of his revelation. Seek Yahweh and live. Do not seek Bethel, and do not enter into Gilgal, or cross over to Beersheba. These were ancient sanctuaries. Don't go there to seek the word of God. Seek God within you, in your souls. Amend your ways and your doings. Do not trust in these deceptive words. This is the temple of Yahweh, the temple of Yahweh, the temple of Yahweh. The people believed that as long as the temple of Adonai stood in Jerusalem, nothing could happen to them, because God dwelt there. God would not permit his temple to be destroyed or his holy city to be laid in ruins. The prophets warned the people against that notion. The original Torah of Moses said nothing about sanctuaries and nothing about sacrifices. And the prophets spoke in the name of a religion long established, whose authority had been largely flouted by the people of their day to their own hurt. And the teachings of these prophets, for all their superb emphasis and elaboration and application, did not represent any new theological or ethical development in the religion of Israel. The later rabbis of the Talmud, declared that had not Israel sinned, only the five books of Moses and the book of Joshua would have been given unto them. The prophetic books would not have been necessary, because God sent the prophets only in his anger because the people of Israel were not obeying the laws of the Torah. Now, there was a great deal that was new in the prophets. What was new in their preaching was, first of all, the extraordinary earnestness and passionate intensity with which they uttered their message. Theirs was a spiritual and ethical fervor utterly unknown in the ancient world. You don't find it anywhere. You don't find in the 8th through the 6th century before the coming era among the Greeks or the Egyptians or the Babylonians or Assyrians moral preachers and teachers arising who spoke with such earnestness and passion in defense of the moral law, in defense of justice and righteousness and the poor and the oppressed and the widow and the orphan. You don't find it anywhere in the ancient world. What was new then in the preachings of these prophets of ancient Israel was the extraordinary earnestness and passionate intensity with which they uttered their message. Theirs was a spiritual and ethical fervor utterly unknown in the ancient world. They restated the centuries-old principles of their faith and the commitments of their people under the covenant with Adonai, with a vividness, a glow, and a forthrightness, which made them sound both new and at the same time disturbingly reminiscent to a generation which had grown hard of heart, whose ears were heavy, and whose eyes were shut. In their restatements, they did not add anything new to the original Torah, but they plumbed its depths. They applied it directly and specifically to the evils and the sins of their days. They elaborated upon it, often in the face of danger and death. At times they spoke in words of wrath and pain, at other times in pity and tender pleading. The prophets were the great and inspired preachers of ancient Israel. And there was something else that was new and original with the prophets. What was substantially new in their preaching concerned the future. The end of days, the Acharit HaYamim, beyond the present. They projected a vision of a distant time when all the nations of the earth would acknowledge Adonai as their God and would live by his law. They saw men and nations reconciled at last in a universal brotherhood of peace. They entertained the hope that Israel, first born to the idea of the one universal spiritual God, might serve as a light to the nations, guiding them to the happy consummation of a free, just, and united world community. And this is particularly true of those prophets who lived in the desperate years of the 6th century, who preached comfort and hope, and who pointed to new horizons to their broken, defeated, exiled, and scattered people. In the original Torah of Moses, there is no reference to Acharit HaYamim, to the end of days, to the kingdom of the future. There is no reference to a world disarmament and universal peace. One finds in the words of Moses deep concern for the protection of the stranger. You shall love the stranger. But it remained for these literary prophets of the later centuries to draw the ultimate implications of the idea of human brotherhood in terms of universal disarmament and a peaceful society of nations founded upon law. It required centuries of living as a nation among nations, which had not yet been done in the days of Moses. It required centuries of living as a nation among nations for the ethical idea of a warless international community to ripen among the spiritual leaders of Israel. The generation of Moses was as yet far removed from that experience and from that vision. That high plateau, that promontory from which this wider panorama of mankind would be seen, had not yet been reached. It remained for the prophets to say, "And it shall come to pass in the end of days, the Acharit Hayamim, that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established as the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. And many people shall go up and say, Come ye, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. And he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. Ki mitzion tetzei Torah udevar Adonai mirushalayim." This vision of an international community is sort of a league of nations all turning to Zion in order to learn the moral law of God, in order to learn how they could live together in peace. That vision first proclaimed to mankind by the prophets. And as a result of this organization, this international society of nations living under the moral law of God, who will judge between the nations and decide for many peoples, they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. It's of interest to note that the original Torah of Moses was directed to the Jewish people. The vision of the prophets reached beyond the boundaries of the one people and reached out to the nations of the world. And the prophets, as you heard read this morning from the first chapter of Jeremiah, who was perhaps the greatest of the prophets, "Navi lagoyim netaticha." I have set thee as a prophet for the nations. They spoke to all the peoples of mankind, not only to the Jewish people. The original Torah of Moses, the Ten Commandments, and all the ethical teachings appended thereto, was of course often ignored and flouted by the people. Could not be otherwise. People were unprepared for it, for all that it called for. Perhaps never would be prepared fully for it. We are not yet fully prepared for it ourselves today. Its total rejection of all nature worship, of all polytheism, of all forms of idolatry, its austere, non-ritualistic worship of the one unseen and unimaged Adonai, its high ethical demands, and its summons to total and exclusive dedication, was the most daring upward leap yet made in the spiritual life of mankind. Here man was suddenly challenged to draw himself up to his full height as a child of God. But unfortunately, the downward drag of the old ways of life, the old beliefs, the old customs, were always there and would always be there. The incrusted customs and the pressures and the allurements of the environments where the people lived, which pushed the ideals frequently brutally aside. And the Torah of Moses had to do battle for survival. But it always found stout hearts to defend it. And among the stoutest and the bravest were these prophets of Israel. The story of the religion of Moses is a story of a struggle. At times uneven, apparently doomed and hopeless. A struggle to preserve itself pure from dilution and secure from submergence. And oftentimes kings and nobles and priests and the common people would conspire to dilute it and to submerge it. They would prefer the ways of the heathen, Egypt, Canaan, Syria, Babylon, all the neighbors. Let us be like all the nations, like the families of the earth, and worship wood and stone. At times the people would blame all their misfortunes on the intrusion of Adonai and his Torah into their lives. As for the word which you have spoken to us in the name of Adonai, we will not listen to you, but we will do everything that we have vowed, burn incense to the Queen of Heaven, and pour out libations to her as we did, both we and our fathers, our kings and our princes, in the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem. For then we had plenty of good, and we prospered and saw no evil. But since we left burning incense to the Queen of Heaven and pouring out libations to her, we have lacked everything and have been consumed by the sword and by the famine. And the people would persecute the prophets who confronted them with the demands of the original Torah. And some they would slay. But there would always be faithful ones, sometimes only a few in number, who took the Torah of Moses very much to heart, lived by it, fought for it. And there were those who died for it. When the tribes of Israel left Egypt around the 13th century before the Common Era, returned to Canaan and settled down to an agricultural life, the threat to the faith of Moses and his Torah, which they had received at Sinai, increased greatly. There were in Canaan Jews, Hebrews, who had not gone down to Egypt, who remained there while the rest of the people were in Egypt. These fellow Hebrews who had not gone down to Egypt, but had remained in Canaan, had through the centuries become largely assimilated with the other settlers of the country, generally designated as Canaanites, many of whom belonged to the same Semitic stock as did the Hebrews, who spoke the same language. And the way of life of these Hebrews and their religious practices came to differ very little from the people about them, with whom they freely intermarried, although they did not amalgamate with them completely, remained aware in some way of their own ancestral tribal God, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. It is with these more or less assimilated Israelites who did not participate in the migration to Egypt that the staunch Yahvist protagonist who entered the country with Joshua, who had received the Torah from Moses, who had made the covenant with Adonai, that these staunch Yahvehs had their greatest difficulties. The Yahveh faith of Moses was not known to them. They had not entered into the new covenant, as did those who stood with Moses at Sinai. But even those who came in with Joshua, the invading Israelites, who had come from Egypt, even they could not long resist and fully resist the cultural and religious influences of the Canaanites, even though they were the conquerors. In the course of time, they too appropriated many of the Canaanitish forms of worship. For example, the Israelites took over from the Canaanites their great agricultural festivals, which were connected naturally with the seasons of the year in Palestine. Now the rituals which were connected with these festivals, which were in the hands of an elaborate priesthood, an institution which was alien to the religion which Moses taught. These rituals were often gross and cruel and obscene, and many Israelites copied them. And while not abandoning Adonai and his worship, they introduced forms also of Baal worship and Asherah worship into the worship of Adonai. Religious, what we call religious syncretism, that is religious compromise, was a common practice in the ancient world as it is in the modern world. And this stultifying syncretism persisted in various degrees among the masses of the ruling circle and even the religious leaders throughout the period of the conquest and settlement of Canaan, and even later on during the period of the kingdoms until their final destruction of the kingdom of Israel in 721 before the Common Era, and the destruction of the kingdom of Judah in 586 before the Common Era. Now, with the establishment of the kingdom in the year 1000 and its growing contact by way of trade and commerce and diplomacy with the neighboring peoples and empires, a process which began with the defeat of the Philistines, foreign gods and their cults were steadily introduced. Cults of the Phoenician deities, Babylonian and Assyrian and Egyptian. And this did not happen under the reign of King David, who was himself zealously devoted to Yahweh and single-hearted in his worship of him. And during his lifetime and during the lifetime of his predecessor Saul, Yahvism was unchallenged in Israel. But a radical change occurred in the latter part of the reign of King Solomon. And from then on, Yahvism entered upon periods of dilution and attenuation and assimilation. There were times, to use the word of the prophet, when as many as your cities are your gods, O Judah. The trend towards religious assimilation was constant and massive, and the universal example of the nations round about them was well nigh irresistible. For there were always those who remained loyal to the old tradition of Moses and his original Torah, who resisted assimilation and syncretism with fierce determination. And in every age, there were Yahveh champions, prophets, like Samuel, Nathan, Ahijah, Elijah, Elisha, Micaiah ben Imla, and later on, the great literary prophets. And thanks to these leaders, thanks to their labor and sacrifices, the original Torah of Moses was preserved. Thanks to their passionate advocacy, the heroic teachings of justice and love and freedom and human dignity and equality before the law have echoed down the ages. The words of these prophets challenged every tyrant and oppressor of mankind to this day. They inspired the idealist and the revolutionist in all parts of the world to fight for the rights of man and for the building of the good society. Their vision of a redeemed mankind turning from hate to brotherhood, from war to the pursuits of peace, has never been dimmed. And it burns as bright today as in the ages of the past, although men in many parts of the world choose to turn away from the light and to shut their eyes to it. And if ever our world, which is still so steeped in barbarism, in hate and exploitation, in bigotry, in war, and in preparations for war, the very things against which the prophets uttered their bitter words of invective and condemnation, if ever our world is to be saved from the abyss, it will only be as a result of men and women who remain faithful to the teachings of these prophets, who follow through in their spirit unafraid, who raise their voice fearlessly against those who add house to house and field to field until there is no room to live in, who grind the faces of the poor, who shed innocent blood. If our world is to be saved, it will be because there, in our day, there will be men and women who will speak up as true and faithful disciples of these prophets. I've just come back from a part of the world, a beautiful part of the world, where the good Lord has been so kind to his people, given them gracious and beautiful lands, rich in everything that man would require, scenic grandeur, wealth and treasures of earth, mine, field. Everything is beautiful, but man is ugly. So much of poverty and misery, degradation everywhere. On the one hand, a little group of people living in luxury, building themselves mansions. On the other hand, hillsides terraced up to their very top with thousands of hovels, huts, miserable dwelling places built out of gasoline cans, tin cans. Unspeakable misery and poverty. I visited a country, one of the richest countries in the world, the second largest oil-producing country in the world. Untold wealth. You visit a capital city, and a section of it looks like a little Paris. Champs-Élysées, beautiful buildings, an officers' country club, the like of which I have not seen anywhere in the United States. When you look up and about you, the masses of the people living in conditions of unspeakable degradation. A government corrupt, foul with graft and corruption. And do you wonder why you hear today such rumblings from that part of the world? Such ominous threats of revolution and upheaval? How else will these people come into their own? Either there will arise among them disciples of the prophets who will call for justice, justice, or the masses of the people will arise in their anger and their desperation to break off their shackles, and there will be bloodshed. Oceans of it. These prophets of Israel summed it up for all time and for all mankind. Thou hast been told, O man, what is good, and what the Lord doth require of thee, only to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God.